Welcome to the Anesthesiology Journal podcast, an audio interview of study authors and editorialists.
Hello, I'm Bobby Jean Schweitzer, an associate editor for Anesthesiology, and you are listening to an anesthesiology podcast designed for physicians and scientists interested in the research that appears in our journal. Today, we are speaking with the author of a publication that will be published in the September 2022 issue of the journal. With us is Dr. Mats Endlund. Dr. Endlund is the first author of an article titled Volatile versus Propofol General Anesthesia in Long-Term Survival After Breast Cancer Surgery, a National Registry Retrospective Cohort Study. Dr. Endlund is Associate Professor at the Center for Clinical Research in Uppsala University and a Senior Anesthesiologist in the Department of Anesthesia and Intensive Care at Västmanland Hospital, both in Västerås, Sweden. Welcome, Dr. Endlund.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
So maybe before we dive into the specifics of your study and article, can you maybe briefly just give us a summary of what question or questions you wanted to address with this work?
Well, the question of the possible effect of different long-term outcomes after cancer surgery, depending on the choice of anesthetic, has been going on for several years now with many observational studies and even four meta-analyses. And it seems as if propofol may have an advantage over volatiles. But for breast cancer, there are several retrospective studies suggest that there is no difference. And we thought that ahead of data from a randomized controlled trial, we may bring a bit more light on the question by merging data from two national registries.
So what registries did you utilize for this?
It was the National Breast Cancer Registry and the Swedish Perioperative Registry. The first one is established since long, whereas the latter is relatively new, starting in 2011 with the first, sharp report for 2013. The degree of coverage increased for this registry quite rapidly, and today all public hospitals and some of a few private-driven surgical healthcare organizations report to the registry.
Just from Sweden, or is it from other countries as well?
It's purely national Swedish, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So why did you want to specifically, I guess, compare propofol versus inhalational anesthetics? I think you mentioned how there may be some evidence that propofol has advantages, but there's other options, I guess, as well with other anesthetic agents. So why the propofol versus inhalational?
Yeah, it is proposed from a number of retrospective studies that there is a difference in long-term outcome between, on the one hand, propofol, and the other hand, volatiles. But breast cancer seems to be an exception from that pattern. And, well, we ourselves, a few years ago, merged data from seven Swedish hospitals, and the result seemed to support four Asian studies, all indicating no difference. That is to say, that study was, we didn't know how to understand it, because when we adjusted for the hospital / study center in a propensity score match, then there was a tremendous difference in survival advantage propofol, despite that we lost a huge part of the pairs in the match. And the analyses were made by the book, so to speak, but we really couldn't believe in the result. So we'd like to expand the database to be nationwide and to include several years to get good numbers. And we would like to have it as a test balloon, since we will have results from an RCT, which concerns breast cancer, at the beginning of next year, and that will give us, let's say, the truth. And then the question is, how well will a national registry-based study fall out compared with a properly powered RCT? And there will come a second test balloon with colorectal cancer next year as well. And if those test balloons do well, we may have a reasonably good evidence base for other cancers. We will go through about a dozen of other cancers later on, for which there are no RCTs going on, or for which such results would take many years to come.
So are there biologically, you know, basis for explanations for why certain anesthetic drugs would or should make a difference in cancer survival, either in general or specifically for breast cancer?
Yes, there are plausible biological mechanisms that can explain such a difference. Firstly, propofol seems to have an anti-inflammatory effect in rodents as well as in humans, in contrast to a pro-inflammatory effect from volatiles. This means that the inflammatory process started by the surgical trauma will be dampened by propofol, while it will be fueled and further exaggerated by volatiles. And it's known that this inflammation is unfortunate from a cancer healing point of view. Further on, different immunological effects on the cell-mediated tumor defense system have been found in humans. For example, T killer cells seem to be affected positively by propofol, but negatively by inhalants. And this is also shown for breast cancer. Secondly, it seems as if inhalants are genotoxic in humans, while propofol is not. If such a genotoxic capacity has an impact during cancer surgery is unclear, but it feels theoretically unsound. And a third mechanism is the opposite effects from the different anesthetics on hypoxia-inducible factor, which is a transcription factor that will be upregulated in a growing solid tumor when the core of the tumor gets hypoxic. And then a number of adapting events will follow, aiming to make tumor cells viable. So when a patient is anesthetized with, for example, sevoflurane, the tumor cells will upregulate this factor, and cells that have been shed out during surgical manipulation will be more likely to survive to a local recurrence, or if they enter the bloodstream, have a better chance of establishing metastasis. Propofol does not upregulate hypoxia-inducible factor. So, yeah, there are some plausible biological mechanisms. Mm-hmm.
Interesting, very interesting. So what did you anticipate that you would find before embarking on this study?
Yeah, we hypothesized a difference of 5 percentage points higher 5-year survival based on the result from our first retrospective study from 2014 that described the benefit for propofol on long-term cancer survival. But to be honest, our expectations were more to find no difference based on the results of the later studies. I mean, our later study from seven Swedish hospitals and the 4 Asian studies I mentioned.
Can you give us a little bit more information about that? You've mentioned about some various studies about cancer and breast cancer, specifically survival after surgery and anesthesia. And I think there has been some differences in results of studies. Can you kind of summarize, I guess, where the field is before your
well,
study?
Well, the mentioned Asian studies indicated no difference in survival, and our own study, the one with the 7 Swedish hospitals, may be interpreted to show no difference as well, although we had this confusing last step in our propensity score match. And as a matter of fact, the first 2 studies in this field, ours published in 2014, and a larger study from London, UK in 2016, were no exceptions. However, in the publications, only average results were presented. In our case, this was a decision by the editor. And I know by communication with the first author in the London study, Tim Wigmore, that when looking at breast cancer separately, there was no difference. I think they have that in a supplementum. That was, by the way, a publication in Anesthesiology. And all those 7 studies mentioned now were retrospective. The only properly powered RCT presented no difference in survival between propofol and sevoflurane for breast cancer when analyzing minimum one-year follow-up. The mean was, I think, 2.9 years. That's a short follow-up time for breast cancer since it has a very high survival rate. But as said, we will make a second follow-up for this RCT later this year with minimum five-year follow-up time. And probably, I guess, we will have an average follow-up time, perhaps 8 years or so.
So how many patients and what percentages, I guess, of the total cohort received propofol versus the inhalational anesthetics?
Well, it was quite 19,000 patients almost, almost three quarters were given propofol, and just one quarter was given an inhalant.
Were you able to determine if the patients received regional anesthesia as well? I know that's been published a bit about the avoidance of even, right?
Yeah, the Sessler study, I know. Well, such information is registered, but less than 1% received a regional block, which was a bit surprising, I must say. But practically all patients received wound infiltration. But that is, of course, quite a different story.
What about the use of opioids? Because that's also been a controversial topic within cancer.
Unfortunately, opioids are not specifically registered. The perioperative register is not that detailed. Opioid-free anesthesia is slowly establishing in Sweden. My guess is that opioids were used for practically all patients in this study, but how much and what about post-operative pain relief, that is not documented.
So presumably, I guess, if they were equal amounts in both groups of opioids or regional, then that would
The regional we know. Opioids we don't know, but it's a good guess that it should be equally distributed between the groups.
So were there any patient characteristics that differed between the two groups of patients with the two different types of anesthesia? I guess why would somebody choose propofol versus inhalational?
Definitely so. The patients given volatiles were older, they were sicker, and the breast cancer was more advanced. And that's a good illustration of the disadvantage of observational studies, where chance is the researcher's worst enemy, while chance is the researcher's best friend in randomized studies. Certainly, it's possible to adjust statistically for unequal distributions, for example, with propensity score matching. But this requires good characterization of every patient with a good coverage of all possible confounders and effect modifiers. Nevertheless, there is always residual confounding beyond control. While in an RCT, chance will distribute everything evenly, including unknown factors.
So you mentioned propensity scoring, and I think you used propensity score matching in this study. Can you tell us what that is and why you used it?
Yep. In order to study the treatment effect on a specific outcome of interest, propensity score matching has become a popular alternative to traditional adjusted regression models. The basic idea is to create patient pairs, one from each group, and the two in the pair shall be as similar as possible within certain limits to mimic the effect of randomization in an RCT. For example, in this study, same age, same weight, same ASA class, same cancer characteristics, same adjuvant and neoadjuvant treatments, etc. Sex was not a big deal in this study for obvious reasons. Then, depending on how many factors of interest are at hand and the degree of variation within the various factors, the number of possible pairs will vary between studies. Under good circumstances, the loss of patients is low, thereby maintaining a good amount of information. If the degree of variability is large for the factors of interest, there will be few pairs created. Then the definition of what can be classified as the same can be changed by increasing the degree of tolerated difference up to a certain limit to keep up the number of possible pairs. In this study, we were lucky to have quite a big number of pairs with quite narrow limits.
What was the length of follow-up after these surgeries? I know you mentioned it one study being, you know, too short of a follow-up.
Yeah, it was not that impressive in this study either. The median follow-up time differed also for the two groups, 2.9 years for those receiving volatiles and 2.2 years for the propofol group. The longest follow-up time was 6 years, and that was for about 4% of the patients. Yeah, as you say, the follow-up time for breast cancer should be longer than for other forms of cancer. So in this perspective, the follow-up time is short, but not pointless.
Yeah, and in most studies, that would have been a very decent one. But it is, breast cancer is one of those interesting, you know, where 20, 30 years may not be long enough. Were these registries able to capture 100% of patients for follow-up?
Yeah, the reporting cancer to our national cancer registry is mandatory by law. And so it's down to 100%. But that register contains much less data than the specific organ registries. For example, the National Breast Cancer Registry. Reporting to that registry is not mandatory, but the cover rate is high, 99% compared with the National Cancer Registry. Concerning the Swedish perioperative registry, all Swedish public hospitals, which are a strong majority of Swedish healthcare, report to the registry, and some of the few private healthcare organizations do as well. So the loss of data is fairly low, and the cover rate is supposed to be 93.5% at the moment.
Did you look at only survival, or were you able to also look at recurrence of breast cancer?
Yeah, we asked the registry for recurrence, but they denied us recurrence data, and they did so for quality reasons. They wouldn't leave them out, since they think the quality is not top-notch. So we only looked at survival.
And what was the final number of patients that you had in your study, and how many were you able to provincially score match as well?
Yeah, the total number of patients was, to be exact, 23,545. And after elimination of, for example, incorrect anesthesia code and duplicates, we ended up with 18,674, of which we could use about half the number, 9,316 to be exact, in the propensity score match.
Were you pleased with that number, or you think it was deficient?
Yeah. Our statistician, Anders Berglund, I think, he's pleased with that.
And what did you find?
Before statistical adjustment with propensity score match, we saw a survival advantage for propofol, starting about a year after the procedure. I mean, the Kaplan-Meier graph curves started to separate after about 1 year. And after 3 years, the difference was 2.5 percentage points. And the explanation to that must be that the propofol group was on average younger, had less comorbidity, and had less severe cancer. If that result had been from an RCT, it would have been sensationally good, having the same impact as a new cancer drug. But after propensity score match, all difference was gone, and the curves in the Kaplan-Meier graph were practically inseparable.
I mean, that's interesting in itself. Why do you think that younger patients and patients with less significant or severe cancer, less advanced disease, got propofol, and the others got inhalational? Is there an explanation that you can propose?
Yeah, we have tried to understand that. A long shot idea would be that elderly patients with, let's say, cardiac comorbidity may have sevoflurane in a higher degree than propofol, because you know, there is an idea that volatiles are better for cardiac patients, which has been put doubts about, but yeah, that may be an explanation, but it's kind of a long shot. Really don't know.
So you discussed a little bit earlier in this about the difference between perhaps breast cancer and other types of cancers and the effect that anesthetics may have. Can you just kind of briefly give us some information on that?
I checked last autumn. I hadn't time to do it now, but I checked last autumn and found 15 retrospective studies with longer survival for propofol patients, and that was for various cancers. But there were also 11 retrospective studies, also with various cancers, without any difference. And of all these 26 studies, only 3 included more than 2,000 patients. 4 meta-analyses have been performed, and all 4 indicate longer survival with propofol. Interestingly, there are 2 large registry studies, both with gastrointestinal cancer. One of them was from Denmark, Hasse Lager and co-workers, as a part of his thesis. They had almost 12,000 patients, and their propensity score match included more than 4,000 pairs. They found a weak association between recurrence and exposure to inhalation anesthesia or colorectal cancer, but no difference in either overall or disease-free survival. And the other registry-based study was even larger, with almost 200,000 patients. It was a Japanese study with Makito as the first author, and that is also an anesthesiology publication. They found no difference in overall survival, but slightly better recurrence-free survival for those given propofol. But to be critical, as they state themselves, their follow-up time was relatively short, just over 2 years in median, and they could, unfortunately, only count those patients who died in the same hospital where they were operated on. Have there been any RCTs? As far as I can see, there are 4 prospective studies undertaken, but they are far too small. The largest contained 126 patients, so no further comments on them. In pipeline, at least at clinicaltrial.gov, there are, or were last autumn when I looked, 9 RCTs. But given the numbers needed in a proper power estimate, I will say that only 3, or with goodwill, 4 of them seem to be properly powered.
Interesting. So this question may still be out there for some time.
Yeah. Yeah, it will take a long time to collect.
Were you actually able to differentiate between different types of volatile anesthetics? Is there any reason why we would think that there would be a difference among them?
The first question, no. Unfortunately, the registry does not discriminate between the types of volatiles. You just fill in a box if there was a volatile, but not which. But we know that sevoflurane dominates the Swedish market, but we don't know to which extent. And second, it must be desflurane. I think, you know, when discussing with colleagues in the country, that I don't think anyone uses isoflurane any longer. Maybe some exception, but mainly sevoflurane, but we don't know to what extent. The second question, we give a reference, the only one I found, to a study from Elias and co-workers in Boston. They created a retrospective study on patients with stage 3 ovarian cancer and found lower overall rate of ovarian cancer recurrence with desflurane compared with sevoflurane. And the difference was as much as 21 percentage points, which is very, very high. But that is only one study and one cancer, so, yeah. We don't know about that.
Yeah, so that seems like a really high difference. And I think you mentioned that if your results had stood after propensity matching, it would have been like the difference of another cancer therapy drug. So in those studies that actually have shown survival differences, are these differences big? Are they relatively small differences?
Yeah. If we just look at the three studies with more than 2,000 patients, starting with our own from 2014, we found a difference of approximately 5 percentage points in five-year survival for a mix of breast and colorectal cancer. And the most of it was for colon cancer. Tim Wigmore and co-workers in London, UK, in their 2016 publication, they had an even larger difference, and that was in a mixture of cancer, mainly into abdominal, but also other cancers. And the difference there, with a median follow-up time of 2.7 years, was 10.4 percentage points. That's much more, perhaps four times more than what can be expected when a drug company launches a new super drug for cancer. And there is also a publication from Tseng and co-workers about gastric cancer that was in 2018. The mean survival time in propofol and sevoflurane groups differed 3.9 months. Which corresponds to a 9% longer survival time for those given propofol. And from a Kaplan-Meier graph for matched patients in that study, it seems as if the difference in five-year survival was 3.5 percentage points.
You mentioned, I think, both in your paper as well as in this interview, that there's a prospective randomized controlled trial underway, expected, I think, results next year. Can you give us a little information about that?
Yes. Based on the data from the 2014 retrospective study of breast and colorectal cancer, we calculated that we would need quite a large number of patients to demonstrate a 5 percentage points difference in five-year survival. For example, we need 1,650 patients with breast cancer. Luckily, we reached that number with an accepted margin of 100 patients to 1,750 patients. We finished inclusions in September 2017. So we can analyze five-year survival for those 1,750 patients later this year. That is to say, it's minimum 5 years follow-up. The median time will be, I guess, between 7 and 8 years. And also in September this year, or rather the last of August, we will close the inclusions for colorectal cancer. And then at the end of next year, we will undertake the first follow-up with minimum 1 year from surgery. And there, I guess, the median follow-up time will be perhaps 5 years at that time. The two cohorts with colon cancer and rectal cancer have been much more troublesome to collect, not the least as the pandemic had an awful impact.
I think you talk about some of the biomarker studies in your paper and the findings and the results of those. Why do you think there is a difference between your study and, frankly, other studies, and yet the biomarker studies? Can you talk about that a bit?
Honestly, I don't understand why. The results from, for example, the group in Dublin, led by Professor Donald Bugge, are convincing. And the theoretical framework with, for example, different effects on the immune system from our different anesthetics is robust. But on the other hand, the whole idea is, I would say, a bit bizarre. I mean, a few hours of exposure to a drug with the acute effects quickly wearing off, can we really expect effects over years from that exposure? I know from the research front on postoperative cognitive dysfunction and from my own thesis that long-term effects from anesthetics can be the case, at least in combination with the surgical trauma. But there is a question mark that should either be stretched out to an exclamation mark or provided with both bold italics and underline.
Well said. I hope today's discussion will interest many of our listeners and lead you to read this important article to learn more. Thank you, Dr. Enlund, for discussing your work with us today. I wish you well as you continue your efforts to enhance the practice of anesthesiology and strive to improve the care of our patients.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Anesthesiology Journal Podcast, the official peer-reviewed journal of the American Society of Anesthesiologists. Check anesthesiology.org for an archive of this podcast and other related content.